That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to The Culture Bunker, your pop culture podcast. I'm Yelena Sofronievic.
And I'm Alex Andreu. This week is a little bit special because we are joined by Sean and Andrew from Glastonbury. So you will be treated to the entire team.
And keeping it strictly music, we went along to see Baz Luhrmann's new biopic, Elvis, with our special guest, Linda Marek. Could we not help falling in love with it, or did we get the GI blues?
Staying with the festival theme, Yelena goes to the Margate Dreamland Leisure Festival with her producer Jade. Was the roller coaster more highs than lows?
All this and more on today's Culture Bunker.
Hello, Yelena. Nice to have you to myself. You've been crisscrossing the country recently, haven't you? Not just for music gigs. Tell all.
No, I was in Oxford a few weekends ago to see the Ruth Asawa Citizen of the Universe exhibition. Now, stay with me on this one because
okay.
I've gone on a bit of a hype recently of exploring Japanese-American women artists who use art to grapple with their trauma. And there are many similarities between Ruth Asawa and her probably much better known counterpart, Yayoi Kusama. But Ruth is just a fascinating woman. She was an American modernist sculptor who's best known for her very intricate wire sculptures. And they're just so fascinating because she spent all of her life living in San Francisco and she was actually interned there during the Second World War. And she used these wires to kind of embody her only what she called tolerable pain. But her forms are almost like molecular biology. And then I went away and did a bit of reading. And it turns out that she was using all these scientific forms to counter the racism of the Second World War and use them to boil it down to the proof of genetic equality. But having
yes,
said...
I think I've seen a few bits at the Guggenheim,
yeah.
Maybe. Do they look like sort of very intricate long lampshades?
Yes, exactly. Think of like the IKEA lampshade.
Yeah.
Du jour. What really permeates throughout the exhibition is there's so much joy and you see all of her different forms of work and how experimental she is. When she was at Black Mountain College, she was using the laundry stamps to make these amazing prints, which then became wallpaper and cushion covers. And she used origami to make performance dance costumes. And it's just incredible. So if you have the opportunity to go down to Oxford, the exhibition is still on until the middle of August, I believe, the 21st of August. So it's well, well worth your time for a free exhibition somewhere that isn't London.
Sounds fascinating.
And you, on the other hand, I understand, have been sampling the delights of the new Paramount Plus streaming service. Found anything especially exciting?
Well, you know me and streaming services, I'm on it. So, yeah, I've been trying out Paramount Plus. I have to say it's a little bit glitchy. I mean, okay, it's very new. The catalogue is not amazing, considering what a massive catalogue the Paramount family of companies have.
Mm.
But I guess that's because they're still getting out of contracts with Netflix, with Amazon, with other streaming people. So as more and more of their stuff runs out of the sort of leasing arrangements that they've got it on now, they will bring it back on. But most excitingly for me as a Trekkie, there's a new Star Trek on there called Strange New Worlds. I watched the first couple of episodes last night, and I absolutely loved it. It's basically, if listeners are familiar with Star Trek Discovery, then there was a sort of side plot line in there about Christopher Pike, who Trekkies will know is the original captain of the Enterprise. He was actually the captain in the pilot of the original series, but because he didn't test particularly well with audiences, they killed him off and made James T. Kirk captain. So Christopher Pike comes back in Discovery as a sort of sideline for a few episodes, having traveled from the past. And that went so well that they've created a whole spin-off series for Captain Pike and his crew. So we are talking here about the decade before the original series. So we're talking about the events that lead up to his death and James T. Kirk taking over. So I thought it was immense fun. And now it's time to take listeners to the very first report by Andrew and Sean from day one of Glastonbury, or possibly from a train stuck somewhere outside Froome. Those are the joys of train strikes. Let's have a listen.
So it's Friday night, and this is Andrew, and this is Sean. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Andrew.
And we're backstage by the park, as you can probably hear by the distant booming.
Yeah.
Of who is it? We've just missed Strike's Leading.
We've missed Arlo Parks, and we're just before St Etienne.
Just before St Etienne. So we're running down the hill to see St Etienne.
Yeah.
It is a slightly misty, slightly vaguely kind of low cloud type of day, but it's been quite a lovely day, hasn't it? Sean, how's your vibe so far of the Glastonbury Pilton Pop Festival 2022?
Well, it hasn't got less popular, is my
vibe.
No, it
certainly hasn't.
The idea that, well, we'll put Wet Leg on a small stage up, you know, on
up the
hill
backwards.
Yeah.
It'll be all right.
Yeah, absolutely. Running up that hill, indeed we were. Wet Leg, if they had been in a venue, would have sold out four times over. We couldn't move.
It was
Wet
Ramo.
Leg, and that was the first band I saw of the festival.
Okay, all
yeah.
right.
What well, do you think of them, Andrew?
I thought they were pretty good. I enjoyed it. The little tiny stick figures of Wet Leg I could see on the distant yes. horizon. I quite enjoyed. The first thing I saw.
Oh, yes, tell me.
The first thing I saw at the Glastonbury Festival moved me to my core because it was a video message from President Zelensky. Saying before anybody came on, saying this is the message to you. I mean, I'm obviously paraphrasing here, but Glastonbury is the greatest expression of freedom that there is, and we want to be able to have our freedom. Mm. And so, please help us spread the word, talk about us, talk to your representatives, talk to your MPs, keep us in the news. And there were huge cheers. And for a festival that has often been very closely associated with Stop the War, i.e. stop literally any war. Yeah. I thought that was actually quite a big deal. That much as I love Glastonbury, on the political side, it can be a little bit kumbaya, hey, let's go to the talking stage, rather than the reality of politics. And this felt like a big change, not only that they would invite him to leave this message, but that it would get such a fantastic reception. There were cheers, there was cheers and tears.
Yeah.
And I think people really, really got it. So that for me, and you know, remembering that this was for years the Glastonbury CND Festival.
Well, I was going to say, I think the most asked question of anything is, how has Glastonbury changed? It's so much bigger, but has it really changed? Is people what people are asking each other. And the fact that the CND, Greenpeace, WaterAid and Oxfam message, amongst other charities, is so strong.
Yes.
And that the charity giving is so strong.
Yes.
The core of the festival still seems really real. So the bigger it gets, and almost, you know, you get so lost within this stuff, it just still seems like the ethos is there, which most festivals have kind of lost by this point. And that's so amazing. And that's kind of what keeps you right, like really on side with this festival, that sometimes can feel like it's got too big.
It's interesting that the stuff that used to be, those crazy hippies with their use less plastic and their stop burning stuff, is now absolutely front centre and the absolute mainstream of politics right now. Mm. So Glastonbury feels like, it obviously Glastonbury sets an agenda. But it's interesting that that is still here, and that other sort of political consciousnesses are coming in. I wasn't at it, but a mini ramen of Oh God, What Now?
Oh, yeah.
Was on the left field. And Patty Chubb, she's a great hit because she's fantastic. But there was an element of, Stop NATO's War there, which apparently was not popular at all.
Right.
People I'm getting this second and third hand, but people really do realise that you can't just have a simplistic war is bad, Boy George, war is stupid and people are stupid thing.
Yeah.
A real thing has occurred in Ukraine that can't just be wished away.
Yeah.
And I've been, really, there's a whole lot of Ukraine flags here.
True, yeah.
And I know it's easy to put a flag up, but you would not have seen flags saying, let's keep fighting in Iraq, would you?
Yeah,
so
indeed.
I think there's some, an element in the consciousness has changed. Well, let's talk about the bands, because this is the culture bunker.
Yes.
The first band I saw was the Libertines.
Oh, no!
Oh, well, never mind.
So Libertines were on, weren't they, at 11 o'clock on Friday morning?
Yeah, three years of no Glastonbury, and let's start with the Libertines. Oh, well, never mind.
What did you think?
It's nice if you like that sort of thing. Anyway, who else did we see? Well, we also went up into the Green Futures Field and saw Nick Turner's Hawkwind Jam
and
session.
And how was it? I did not see that.
Wildly
was
cosmic.
That
about six people in a tent freaking out. You want the true spirit of the festival.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the true. But in terms of actual bands, we all saw Confidence Man.
Yes.
Recently.
And Confidence Man actually blew everyone away that I know who saw them. Oddly, Wet Leg seemed to have more people watching them. Confidence Man have more people talking about them, going, have you seen it? Yeah.
Wet Leg.
They were amazing.
Wet Leg was fun, but Confidence Man was an absolute thing.
Confidence Man was that thing of when dance music is revolutionary.
Yes.
And you get that idea. Because obviously we're only on Friday. We haven't had, the raves of the night, and when you just feel that music actually can set you free for three days. Yeah. So they really did that thing of just getting the audience going and going.
For listeners who don't know who Confidence Man are, they are an Australian four-piece of whom two of them hide in the background because we think they might be about 60.
Yeah.
But the other two, Janet Planet and what's his name,
certainly do not hide in the background.
They do shapes, they hop around, there are costume
changes. And they were absolutely fantastic. So there were three costume changes, weren't there? And
there was a fake fist fight
with
blood.
And they do stupid dancing.
Yes.
You know, it's not something that's highly choreographed. They were really, really good, and they just brought 90s rave back.
What I love about Janet Planet, I've got numerous things I love about Janet Planet. One of the things is she'll do properly choreographed shapes. She'll do, like, look at me, I'm a dancer.
Yeah.
And then she'll do something so wildly and obviously stupid that it undermines everything she's just done, but makes you like it even
Flappy
more.
Flappy Bird dance.
And then the pair of them go off and they come on and she's wearing some kind of spiky Christmas tree dress with conical breasts on it.
which was pretty damn good,
I thought.
So we've got the big hitters, haven't we? We've got Paul McCartney, Billie Eilish, and we've got Pet Shop Boys or Kendrick Lamar.
Yes.
So the stuff to come.
Yeah.
Does Glastonbury, I'm asking you now, Andrew, does Glastonbury need these big hitters? Is it really important
they
get the...
Yeah, it does, because Glastonbury is the grand shop window of pop culture, and it's got to have everybody on. It's a place where people who would not ordinarily go and see Paul McCartney will go and see. But like, I was in the Cornish Bar last night.
The Cornish Bar, which is a
bar that sells Cornish beer, and DJ was playing. He'd worked on this a month. Clearly, it was a Beatles drum and bass set where he'd stripped the vocals off 8 days a week, off Hey Jude, off all kinds, and put them to Jump Up Jungle, and it was all working fantastically.
Yeah.
And the people who are here for Jump Up Jungle obviously know the Beatles, because everybody knows the Beatles, because it comes to you as a child. You never know the first time you hear the Beatles. It's just there.
Yeah.
It's always there. It's like the Bible.
Yeah, it's like nursery rhymes, I always thought.
Yeah, like
something part of your
part
DNA.
Of the fabric of your mind. So we're all, drum and bassing it up to, She Loves You and Paperback Writer. And, paperback writer. Bloody brilliant.
Well, I'm very sad I missed that.
There you go, And so that's just one little thing in one little bar in amongst the hundreds of bars of this place. So, to your question, does Glastonbury need these big hitters? I think the big hitters need Glastonbury.
Yeah.
I think this is the World Cup finals of pop. And if you qualify, you've got to turn up and you've got to give it 110%. Yeah. And Macca, I think tomorrow night, and we'll be recording again. We'll do a little bit of a, later in the show, you'll hear our take on Macca. But Macca's not soft, and he will understand that what you've got to do is you've got to put together a set that represents you, not just people who love you, but to people for whom you're a fringe experience. By the way, also, people we run into on the first day, yeah. Danny Harrison,
yes.
George's son.
Yeah.
We had a nice chat about his jacket. He didn't really want to talk about the Beatles as well as we could tell. We had a lovely jacket
I
on.
I imagine he didn't.
Yeah. We yeah. ran into Glenn Tilbrook of
Squeeze. Yes, that's right.
He was
right.
just wandering around yeah. taking pictures.
Why not?
What a lovely chap he was. Mm. And also this morning when I got up, queuing for oatcakes was Tilda Swinton.
Absolutely. She was talking to her husband.
Yes.
Who is very, very handsome.
Is he got?
Oatcakes. Yeah, and I just thought, well, get you. That's what you need to do, is you have to talk about when your energies get low, what you're going to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. As Tilda Swinton's Staffordshire Oatcakes will be performing at the John Peel stage at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Of course they will.
Yeah.
I was interested to see that self-esteem's not on till Saturday, but I'm seeing self-esteem flags.
So self-esteem.
Here
tell us
there.
Why. Tell us why self-esteem is such a thing.
I think she's going to be one of those things. If she does it right, she's going to be one of the Glastonbury performances
yes.
of this weekend. Glastonbury have been really amazing this year in doing 50% female artists.
Have they actually hit the 50-50?
I believe they have, okay. yeah, with male, which most ones don't do, most festivals don't do. And there's an idea that when we watch Confidence Man and we watch Wet Leg, and we'll be watching St Etienne in a minute, amongst others, there is really hashtag strong woman stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds really cliche, but actually loads and loads of really, really good female voices and good yeah. female experience is now in pop music and in alternative music. And I just have a feeling she's going to nail it.
Okay.
She's going to be that voice of the festival.
Glastonbury is the only time when you talk about pop music that you talk about it as if it's like the Grand National or the European Cup finals. You know, it's like
we
Champions League.
Yeah.
Who's in the group of death?
Yeah.
Oh no, the Libertines. You know,
but I really do think that's going to be the yes. I was there. I saw self-esteem at Glastonbury.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, we've been doing some wandering over the hills and, you know, everything is, you know, as was. And I was expecting to have a major kind of sort of, you know, shock moment because obviously 3 years since I've been here. And I've been coming to Glastonbury since 1987 and it is without question my favourite thing on the planet.
Mm.
Right. Humans notwithstanding. But actually, excluding
certain
humans
as well.
It does
surprise me. I do want to say... You do love robots. I still get surprised that you love Glastonbury as well.
It's when I get down with my real self.
Yeah.
I was expecting to have a kind of a bit of a sort of shock of recognition, but it wasn't. It was like just walking into a place that you know and I've always known well. It's a bit like, I mean, I've now spent months of my life here.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, one thing that you lose is the surprise of believing that the place is infinite and seems to go on forever.
Yeah.
You kind of start to realize where everything is and then it naturally becomes smaller. But, you know, for all that, you know, the lovely, relaxing feeling of like, I'm back now.
Mm.
I'm back where I've got back to where I once belonged. Now, you've not been here in how long?
22 years.
Yeah. The last time you came was 2000.
Yeah,
David
exactly.
Bowie and the Pet Shop Boys year.
Yeah.
A very good year.
Yeah.
He's on this year. The Pet Shop Boys. Time has become
a
loop.
Life is a circle.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's pretty much the same. I mean, really, not much has changed. I was worried...
Except the price of everything has gone up.
Yeah, but...
£9 for your Czech kedgeree.
Well, yeah, but as you know, sometimes we bring our own food in.
Yes.
I had worried that it was going to go all Aintree or Henley and there'd be a lot of...
Aintree?
Someone told me.
If it went Aintree, that'd be brilliant.
Someone WhatsApped me and went, it's gone really Aintree now. In the sense it's going to be corporate stuff backstage and there's going to be some sort of Moet stall that we can't get into or something like that. It's not like that at all.
I mean,
Tilda Swinton notwithstanding.
Yeah.
It's just really normal. It's just a load of people covered in mud. And that's what's so nice about it. And I haven't spotted a supermodel. And I don't want to.
Well, I don't know if the listeners can hear. There appears to be some kind of genial fist fight going on over the hedge.
Absolutely.
But hey, festival times.
That is festival times,
I'm just, the contrast between Aintree and Henley is a vast one. I'd love the, if Glastonbury went Aintree, because I know what Aintree is like at chucking out time. People crawling
that's
along
my
the road.
Friends.
People crawling along the road, not able to hang on to the floor. That's Aintree for you. So you're looking forward to self-esteem. Obviously, I'm looking forward to the Pet Shop Boys as always am.
Yes. Kendrick Lamar, I want to see.
Yeah.
Massively want to see, because he's clashing with the Pet Shop Boys. So saying, of course I'm going to go and see Kendrick Lamar, because that's album of the year.
Yeah. Also, Pet Shop Boys are clashing with Bicep, which is kind of annoying.
I know.
Thanks, Avis.
I want to ask you, Andrew,
yes.
What amazing t-shirts have you seen? Because t-shirts are the barometer, of Glastonbury.
We've seen certain wonderful t-shirts. One genuinely disturbing one, which I'll talk about in a minute, but a guy just strolled past us in it, and it was the Pizza Express logo, but he changed Pizza Express to say Prince Andrew. And I thought, I had to take a picture of this. There's a very friendly young lady next to us in a t-shirt that had a lovely, a pink t-shirt with a big heart, and in you know, the kind of letter, the typeface from a 1970s children's book.
I think it's called
Double Dick or something. It's kind of a very blobby and round and comforting. It said, "I'm scum." And that's a pretty good t-shirt. "I'm scum" in a big one, in a big white heart. That said, and this isn't very nice, we were in the Stone Circle and a woman walked past us in a t-shirt. It was a khaki coloured t-shirt and the slogan was "Arbeit macht frei." And I was genuinely aghast because how in the hell can you not know where that came from? How in the hell can you put it on a t-shirt? How in the hell can you come to the Glastonbury Festival?
And I think it's a hard sell.
It's a hard sell. And there's always been a bit of political weirdness here, a bit of oddness and strange points of view, but I've never seen anything like that.
Mm.
And all of us looked at each other like, did you just see that? Mm. Am I hallucinating? Did you see that t-shirt? So, and I was so gobsmacked, I didn't even have it in me to chase after it. What the hell are you wearing? But I think that's just one thing. I mean, broadly speaking, almost everybody is in great shape. Yeah. Even the guy whose banner over his tent is a picture of Kim Jong-il with "Live, Laugh, Love" on it. Someone call that bad taste. I don't know.
And that should be a t-shirt.
That should be a t-shirt.
Should we do the special mention?
Special mention. Listen up.
This is a special mention, Tim, if you are listening.
Listener to the podcast, Tim.
Yeah, I was walking down one of the roads. I didn't know where I was. I had so much luggage and I was on my own. And listener Tim saved me, who said, "Sean, I listened to the podcast. What are you doing? You look lost." And listener Tim spent a whole hour helping me get to where I wanted to be, which I didn't know because none of the stewards knew. And so we do a very, very special hour.
Did he sort of Sherpa you?
Yeah, he did. He was
in Sherpa.
It's beyond the call of duty. I owe him several pints, which he'll probably now obviously chase up. But listener Tim, thank you so, so very much, because he carried off my stuff as well and made sure that I was found.
God bless him.
Yeah, God bless him.
Listener Tim.
Yeah, there is an angel out there.
There must be an angel playing with my luggage. Well done, listener Tim. Thank you. All right, so it's Friday. We've got another couple of days of this.
We think we look bad now. We'll look bad.
They'll have to just imagine it.
Yeah,
but like basically like a pair of sodden elves.
Yes.
The rain has now started to come down. Yeah. Here comes the rain again. Annie Lennox too.
Yeah. So why does it always rain on us?
Why do we always rave on E? Yes. So I'll hand you back to the studio, and we'll be back to you later in the show, later in time.
Yes.
When God knows
what'll happen. Older and wetter.
But wiser, possibly. Who knows?
Elvis, as the name cunningly suggests, is Baz Luhrmann's biopic on the life of Elvis Presley, played by newcomer Austin Butler. It is a tale told primarily from the point of view of his Svengali-like manager, Colonel Tom Parker, played by Tom Hanks, very much in child catcher mode. Here's a little taste.
Are you born with destiny? Or does it just come knocking at your door?
He's a young singer from Memphis, Tennessee. Give him a warm hayride welcome. Mr. Elvis Presley.
Get a haircut, buttercup.
In that moment, I watched that skinny boy transform into a superhero.
We went to see it with our good friend and Culture Bunker regular, Linda Marrick, who joins us in the studio. Hello, Linda.
Hello. Hi, guys. How are you?
Nice to have you. Now, Linda, this is, I think, it's fair to say, less a biopic and more a Baz Luhrmann film, right?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah.
He takes quite a few liberties with the facts because he's more interested in the spectacle.
Yes,
but does that serve the story of a man who became so much larger than life? He was both musician and spectacle.
I think this was the only way this film could have been made, in my opinion.
Mm.
I mean, it doesn't really deal with the things that make him look bad, because obviously the estate, Presley estate, agreed to the film. So you have to kind of really walk on eggshells around that, some of the more shall we say, icky things. But at the same time, I think this is the best way to make this film, because he was such an extraordinary character, such a sort of an ethereal character, that you had to make the film look like a fairy tale almost, if you know what I mean.
No, I know exactly what you mean. It's like everything from really when he was a kid, everything is driving towards those incredible, gaudy Las Vegas shows in a way.
Absolutely.
Elvis's career spans many decades and hundreds of songs, obviously, and films that attempt to cover such epic spans can occasionally become little more than sort of back catalogue videos. Mm. There have been a few recently that I thought you're just inventing reasons to sort of touch on the most famous songs. How was this one structured?
I agree with you on that point, but I think there are some films that were really well done, like Rocket Man. I thought that was brilliantly done, the Elton John story. Again, it had the same kind of air, you couldn't really tell a straightforward story. You had to tell a story through the music, and I think that's the only way it works, the only way to get the fans in.
Well, how does Lerman structure the film while avoiding, like, packing it with every single song Elvis ever sung, if you know.
He more or less does, doesn't he, though? Even if it's all, some of them are just snippets. He does avoid it by sort of jumping all over the place. It's not very well structured, the film, is it? But at the same time, it's very, very pleasing, because there isn't, you couldn't think of a Elvis Presley number that isn't really there, that isn't there. And I think every sort of most memorable part of his career is represented in that. And I kind of like that. I really like that. I think I'm not entirely sure what people will make of it, mostly because of the way it's been marketed. Because it has been marketed as just a straightforward biopic, but it isn't a straightforward biopic. It is beautifully shot. And I think I really loved it, I have to say. I don't think it's perfect. I think there are things within it that are done very awkwardly and very sort of, not quite like the stuff with the musical appropriation, for black music appropriation, all that stuff. I think that's not dealt with properly. But at the same time, I think if that is the only thing I have against it, then I'm happy to sort of ignore that bit. Yeah.
Alex, we were both quite apprehensive about watching this because we like Elvis, but we're not proper fans of his music. What did you make of it?
I have to say I was apprehensive going to see it, mainly because I think the trailers do the film enormous injustice.
Yep.
Actually, they're quite bland and dead, and they look like they could be cut from every other biopic ever made about a singer. Mm. And the film actually is not that at all. It is basically Moulin Rouge 2. That's what it felt like to me. It's like a glitter ball exploding in your face, literally from the first second.
Alex, I'm so happy you said that. I am so happy that you said that, because I had this worry that people might think it's a bit too Lerman-ish, but
like Lerman. Yeah. The thing is, I like Lerman. What I would say is people who look at that trailer and go to see a sort of dramatic biopic may be disappointed. People who love Lerman and go to see a Baz Luhrmann film will be delighted.
Absolutely.
Biopics live and die by their central performance. So what did you think of Butler's?
So I think it's, I mean, it's a really difficult one, isn't it? You wouldn't wish it on someone as an acting challenge. But I think he does an incredible job. And what's interesting is that he's a really young, slight thing, but it's actually when he's playing the older, more burdened, more bulky Elvis that I thought he really came into his own. First of all, the first thing to say is that he's got the speaking voice absolutely bang on. And that's a big, big, big thing for a biography film. The second thing to say is that he sings all the songs. Now, for young Elvis, he sings all the songs unaided by electronic enhancement, as it were. As Elvis gets older, they blend his voice with the older Elvis voice, because I guess it's, you know, it's an impossible task for a 21-year-old to sound like a 45-year-old, if you know what I mean. So as he gets older, they blend Elvis's voice and he sounds more and more like Elvis. And I thought that was actually quite a good feature of the thing. I just thought he had poise and he had presence and he had gravity and he had a lot going behind the eyes that with someone else in the part, the movie might feel a lot more superficial than with him, actually.
I thought he was fantastic. I know it's very early to start talking about award season and everything.
Oh, he'll win it.
Genuinely, if he doesn't get a nomination for the Oscars, then I don't know what I'm talking about, and you should never invite me on the show again. I think he is fantastic. He is, you know, Lerman auditioned Harry Styles, who I absolutely adore, who is fantastic, you know, as a singer and as a performer, as a person, really. But I don't think anyone could have done better than Austin Butler. I think this role he was born to play, and he was fantastic. He doesn't look terribly like Elvis, but that doesn't matter because he doesn't even, he's not like a copycat, and he doesn't look like a sort of someone doing an Elvis impersonation. And I think that's really important. I think that's really, really important that he doesn't sort of fall into mimicking. He embodies it. And I just think, I also think the way, to go on too much. I think also the way Baz Luhrmann films him is very interesting. So many close-ups and the sweat on his face and the sort of the hip wiggling and the sort of...
It's heavily erotic, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's heavily, heavily erotic.
Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous.
I want to know what you thought, Yelena, because you have a special family connection. You've grown up with his music and his legend around the house. Did the film live up to it for you?
It did in many ways, and it captured all of the fantastical elements of his lifestyle that I think you make allusions to with my family. I mean, my brother once dressed up as Elvis for a primary school talent show. My grandmother made him the whole white catsuit affair. And we have very loving pictures. My mum's even been to Graceland and she's a very, very big fan. So I know that they'll both be very excited to go and see this. I want to come back to what you were saying about Baz Luhrmann, though. I was reading an interview with him where he said that every film of his was inspired by Elvis.
Oh, that's lovely.
And I agree that I think that this is really the sort of apex of his style, if you will, in the same way as us watching The French Dispatch by Wes Anderson last year. It's very overwhelmingly him. But what this does so well, I think, is appropriate that carnival location that we see in perhaps the Moulin Rouge and use it as a kind of symbol of the media and celebrity circus that was around Elvis. I think that was so clever. So Tom Hanks as Colonel Tom Parker almost comes off like Harold Zidler in the film. And he talks about wanting to create the greatest show on earth and gaslighting Elvis basically for his ability. Those early scenes where they're at the carnival, where he's guiding his way out of the Hall of Mirrors and they're going on this Ferris wheel of fortune, which is almost like Evelyn Waugh, decline and fall. It's so, so clever. So I really loved those elements of it as well, the sort of freak show that is perpetuated around Elvis. I think that's so clever.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. He placed it firmly in a sort of carnival context. What did you think of Tom Hanks? I was in two minds about him because it's a very broad performance. You know, it's painted in very primary colors, but then again, you know, the film is so brassy and big that I think anything more nuanced might have gotten lost in it.
Yeah.
And I found the duality of his character actually quite interesting in that you know, he was overtly, you know, taking advantage. He was overtly wicked and taking advantage of Elvis. But at no point did I feel myself doubt that he also absolutely loved Elvis.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite a hard thing to pull off.
I think there was perhaps a little bit more nuance. I got a bit more nuance than you did, Alex, in that I think that sometimes Colonel Tom's narrative really seems to dominate it in the early parts of the film, perhaps. But then at other times, we really hear Elvis talking for himself a bit more. And ultimately, so much of Colonel Tom's dialogue in the film addresses us. He says you as the audience and how our own consumption and our love for Elvis, if you will, is complicit in his demise. I think the film really tries to use this as a personal story to tell a wider history about not just US music, but US consumerism in music. And it made me think of almost what the Lehman trilogy did about US capitalism. Like, there's so much throughout this film that's so American. Even the way that they blend the original documentary footage with the film itself to make these pop culture references. There's one bit where there are these music mashups and you have Viva Las Vegas interspersed with Toxic by Britney Spears. And I just thought that was so clever to comment on how these exploitative contracts are very much still a problem in the music industry now. And there's so much that Colonel Tom does to kind of claim this, that he was the one to start it all off. But the way that that's represented is actually more subtle than you might think.
But I think that the crux of it is that he is painted by the film's narrative as an unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
We know that we can't trust anything he has to say. And whatever he says, Lerman is showing us exactly the opposite of what the colonel is claiming, so that we know that he is the villain of the piece straight away. But I also wanted to say I've said this elsewhere, and I've said it almost feels like a horror movie, like you know when you try where our hero is trying to get out to escape his tormentor never quite making it. That's how I felt about him. Every time there was thought of him getting on a plane and going abroad, there was something keeping him there. It almost felt like a sort of a horror narrative, a horror sort of device.
There's a sort of black swan atmosphere to it. You're right. Linda, one last thing. I can't not comment on this. At times, Elvis is painted as a sort of one-man culture-transforming civil rights advocate.
Yeah.
Is that hagiography or portraiture? And does it matter, you know, in this kind of film? Do you want the historical bits that are inserted in there to be vaguely accurate, or does it not matter?
I think it's very important to sort of make a point that he could have made loads of comments. He could have come out very early on, and because he grew up in Memphis, he could have come out very early on and talked about civil rights, the first civil rights movement. He never did. He was surrounded by black musicians who he was great friends with. And people would say, yes, the colonel wouldn't let him speak and told him never talk about religion or politics. But at the same time, he was his own man. And even when he was surrounded by all those hippies at the end of the 60s, he could have sort of made more of an effort to say things, you know, but he never really did. So I think there's a clumsy effort to sort of sugarcoat or sort of whitewash that part of him, which I don't think works in the film. But at the same time, I almost feel sorry for him. I almost feel like he wasn't surrounded by the right people to tell him, yes, you can come out and say the things that you believe. Nothing bad is going to happen to you. And I just felt very sorry and very sad for him as a person, really.
So that's three thumbs up from us, I think. And Elvis is on general release around the UK from this weekend.
Oh, we do like to be beside the seaside. Leisure is an all-new independent festival mixing music and amusement rides at Margate's Dreamland Park. Headlining the day-long affair is Mitski, hot off supporting Harry Styles on tour and ahead of her Glastonbury debut this weekend. So what does it take to set up a seaside festival? Producer Jade Bailey and I are heading east side to catch up with Leisure's organisers from Bird on the Wire and Lineup Stars High School.
I'm Clemence.
And I'm Tim.
We run Bird on the Wire. We're London promoters, but obviously today we're not in London. So we run some events around the UK occasionally as well.
So Leisure's a mix of festival and funfair, all set on England's east coast. Why did you pick Dreamland? Why this venue in particular?
I guess because it has an inbuilt structure. It's quite close to London, so people can travel easily. although we've had some issues this weekend. Generally, it's quite easy to get to from London, which we kind of see. Kind of a core audience does come from London to these events.
And it's really an iconic venue as well. It's right on the beach, which is really nice. You walk out of here and you're, I think, on one of England's beautiful beaches.
Yeah.
Sand beaches. So, yeah.
So this is the first edition of Leisure. And on your website, you say that it's run by passionate independent promoters. What made you want to set up a unique festival as a sort of counter, perhaps, to some of the bigger mainstream festivals?
I guess it comes from the fact that we are always trying to create events that we enjoy going to. So I think there's a lot of that. I think with this lineup, we really tried to show that you could have really amazing artists on the lineup and really strong headliners that were not necessarily headliners on other regular festivals.
Yeah, we always try and champion new music, so emerging acts. Kind of what we do with our events and our promotions as well.
So you've got Mitski headlining ahead of her Glastonbury debut this weekend. Having seen her in Brixton last month, I can attest I'm very excited to see her ever so slightly closer to the stage this time. Who else is performing? Who else should we watch out for?
We have C-Map. You may be able to hear in the background. I think she's great, and I think she's going to do really well over the next few years. Soccer Mummy released their album today. It's worth checking out.
Surf Girls, their American band, really like punk and yeah, really good.
So practically then, tell us a little bit more about what goes into planning a festival and perhaps why you chose a one-day format for Leisure rather than splitting it across a few.
Personally, I hate camping. I can't do that anymore. So one day is kind of, yeah, perfect for me. And I think you just kind of have a good, people kind of like book their hotels, and especially here, you can just kind of, it's a bit more relaxed.
It's like, it makes it very special. You're just coming in, you're just like having this big day out, and then you can do whatever you want for the rest of the weekend. So yeah, we do like one day festivals. Yeah.
And how did COVID in particular impact your festival planning? I'm thinking in comparison with your 2019 event here, for instance.
First of all,
we had Clairo pull out due to COVID, so that was something that got sprung on us last night.
Yeah.
It was last night. Yeah. And yeah, as Clem mentioned, we had Surf Coast playing in London, so we could actually make that replacement happen at the very last moment. It was pretty stressful. Mm-hmm. But we got them here. So.
And also, we just confirmed our artists really late this year because there was so much uncertainty about traveling from international traveling. So we actually only announced the festival 3 months ago, which is a really short run-up to the festival.
And more widely, do you think that COVID has made not just festival planners but promoters a bit more conscious of things like environmental considerations? I noticed, for instance, that you're doing a bus share initiative normally to and from London for people wanting to come to Margate.
I think, especially as independents, having environmental policy has been something that we've really been wanting to put together for the last few years, and COVID just gave us more time. Those 2 years gave us more time to actually put it together and really think through what we could do about band riders, about traveling, about all of that.
The sort of the ethos for Leisure is really to create an inclusive, inspiring, and laid-back atmosphere, in your words. When you were designing the festival, did you have things like access in mind? And I mean that with respect to the musicians, you mentioned smaller bands, but also with respect to festival goers. I'm thinking it's very expensive and it's very difficult to get a ticket to something like Glastonbury, which also I hear is happening this weekend.
Yeah. Definitely always something that we keep in mind. We are constantly trying to keep prices down. This is something that coming back after COVID has been possibly a little bit more difficult because a lot of providers, like a lot of costs have gone up, which production costs in general, technical costs. But yeah, we're definitely trying to keep prices as affordable
especially
as possible.
Now we have to worry, kind of like people are kind of saving their money and kind of obviously the state things are at the moment with kind of cost of living crisis, just all kind of people are hearing about. So
And also, I imagine the impact of Brexit on music and performance too. I know that you're both London-based promoters. And I kind of get the impression that the city still dominates the British music scene in many respects. But Clemence, so you're French. How do you think that the Paris and London music scenes compare?
Oh, I haven't lived in Paris for a few years, actually, so it would be difficult. I think they're quite quite comparable in the sense that there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of good things happening in Paris as well. There's always this thing about artists and hospitality in the UK versus hospitality in Europe. So this is definitely something, as we started promoting shows, that was very important to us, was to make sure that artists had, a comfortable time and were felt like they were looked after. Mm. So this is something that we took from Europe, both because I'm French and because Tim was in bands and played in Europe. So we kind of tried to bring that into our world.
You're both co-directors in Bird on the Wire, and other acts on your roster feature many Culture Bunker favourites. You've got Yard Act, The Magnetic Fields, Japanese Breakfast. We're desperate to take her for a Japanese breakfast, by the way, because there's a great place around the corner from us, so pointing out. But also acts like Black Country New Road, Porridge Radio, Angel Olsen. Tell us what other festivals you have in the pipeline and where we can catch some of the other acts too.
So we have a festival called Visions, which is in East London, and it's a multi-venue, five venues, all indoor. We have a few outdoor spaces and a dog show, and that's a very kind of like tastemaker festival where you kind of really push new artists. And Black Country New Road are headlining that festival this year with their new six-piece.
First
London
things.
Show, so that's something before. That's July the 23rd.
And we have a few headline shows that you've mentioned. Yard Act are playing the Forum at the end of the year. Magnetic Fields are playing the Apollo in August, I think, around End of the Road Festival, where there'll be a lot of great bands to catch as well at the beginning of September.
A lot of the acts we book come through Visions Festival as well. So in their early stages, we book them with Visions and then kind of look to build them from that.
And bringing it back to Margate then, I think this is the first music festival I've been to that has an amusement park, a games arcade and a roller disco here to keep us entertained when we're not listening to the music. So as we are in dreamland, I think it's right that I should ask, who would be your dream artist or your dream venue to promote?
We have been ticking boxes. We booked Kim Gordon last month, which was amazing. I mean, dream artist, I'm just booked tickets to see Bruce Springsteen next year in Italy, so I'm going to make a travel to see that. And obviously, that would be a dream.
I would love to do something with Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead. I would love to, create some sort of special event around his music. That would be beautiful. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you both ever so much for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Rory from high school.
Yeah, and I'm Scotty from high school.
Now, as a band, you've had everything from goth pop dream world to new order for 2021, I'm quoting here, ascribed to you. But how would you both describe the music of high school?
Well, they're both very flattering comparisons. I don't know. I think to me, it's like a blend of all the bands that our sort of dads forced us to listen to back in the day, all the 80s stuff compared with like stuff we grew up in the early 2000s, listening to Strokes.
I mean, I like goth pop. I reckon
goth pop works really well, but yeah, a lot of influence from early 2000s as well, like power poppy sort of stuff, and mixed with some 80s, and that's it, high school.
I love Frosting in particular. It's got echoes of sort of New Order's Age of Consent
whenever
I listen to it. So tell me about some of those 80s bands that you were forced to listen to growing up. What's the music that you love?
Well, my old man actually grew up in like the sort of St Kilda post-punk scene.
In Melbourne.
So you're talking, you're kind of Nick Cave, early birthday party, stuff like that. So that was kind of the first sort of stuff that I got properly, listening to and influenced by. But Joy Division, obviously, Bauhaus, New Order, Cure, massive influence, Smiths,
Depeche Mode. I mean, like, it's a good era for music.
Yeah, you know? Like trying to bring it back in a palatable kind of way, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that you grew up in Melbourne, Australia. Obviously, you're here now. It's a country we are familiar with in the UK because it was subject to some of the tightest pandemic restrictions.
Yeah.
And you've been very vocal about how COVID lockdowns have affected your music. So how did it impact things like band practice?
It's funny. It's like every time there's like a write-up about us, it's like, oh, they were through the most extensive lockdown. It was so hard for them. But I think realistically, it was actually like a real sort of silver lining that came out of it. It gave us a chance to kind of not be working like a 9-to-5 and like sneak over to each other's houses during lockdowns and like write music. So obviously it was negative in a lot of ways, but there were some positives that came out of it as well.
Got a
chance to write and live in a sort of apocalyptic world for a minute and kind of draw from that. I don't know.
We should mention as well that Lily is the third member of high school.
Yeah, she is.
Lily is your sister.
Oh, my sister. Yeah. She's watching Seeing That.
Yeah, we couldn't get her here. She just loves too much.
So did you guys effectively move in as a trio and use the time to make music together?
Me and Lil were living together, and then Scotty was kind of like a stone's throw away or whatever. And yeah, just kind of started this COVID baby, basically. It started with Frosting was the first song we wrote. And then, kind of just went from there. It realistically, we were kind of like, oh, this track's like a bit whatever, and then put it out and started to get a bit of traction like over here or whatever. And kind of just went from there.
So your debut EP, Forever At Last, came out in November 2021. Mm-hmm. And it's very dark, it's sprawling, and it has quite a lot of those sort of themes of uncertainty that I imagine would resound with people just coming out of something like a lockdown.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about making that EP then and the songs that comprise it.
Well, I mean, I guess, I don't know. I don't know how much influence the actual lockdown itself had from the songwriting. I mean, it did definitely kind of influence the recording style. We didn't have access at that time to studios and stuff because of lockdown. We didn't have access to gear that we wanted to use, so we kind of had to do it in like quite a DIY sort of fashion, mainly out of my room, Scotty mixing like all the songs.
Yeah.
So I guess that was the lockdown aspect of it that you can really hear, I think, is the fact that we pretty much couldn't really leave our house and we had to do it as kind of makeshift as possible, I guess. That was like,
We did it in our share house with our friend Archie. Shout outs to Archie.
Yeah, floodlights.
Floodlights, check them out. But in terms of like how like the lockdown affected the album, I don't know, like
just meant we couldn't play shows, really. That was like the main thing. And then it meant when we got here, like we could like crack right into it. Pretty unconventional kind of like trajectory high school so far, but
yeah, our first show was in London.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
But what were some of the musical and cultural influences that colored that EP for you?
I mean, I guess just kind of what we covered before, but all sorts of stuff. I mean, we draw influences from like, you know, I listen to like a lot of trap music, like Trippy Red, Lil Uzi Vert,
lots of emo stuff.
Like Scotty's got like the emo influence.
The Tony Hawk Pro Skater 4 soundtrack. It's a big influence.
But we kind of like had the consensus was it was going to be like a post-punky kind of EP, but you know, melodically we draw influence, like I was saying, from trap, from random R&B, from you know, dance music and all sorts of things. It's kind of anything like with a gothic sort of edge as well, I guess.
Even amongst those who weren't forced to listen to 80s music as a child, and I think we're all in that company here, it does feel like there has been a sort of resurgence of interest in not just 80s music but 80s film. I'm thinking of things like Stranger Things, obviously sending Kate Bush back to number one, and I recently came across a playlist on Spotify called Sounds Like the 80s But It's New. I noticed on your Bandcamp that you
surely
guys
get us involved in that
playlist. I noticed that on your Bandcamp you guys are also selling glittery cassette tapes. What do you think of the whole resurgence in 80s interest?
I mean, I feel like you've got a good answer for that, talking about how like the past becomes cool and you know, eventually, you know.
Well, I feel like the past works in like 20-year trajectories, and like the 80s is like 40 years away. Okay. So it's kind of like we're obsessed with like the early 2000s. If you haven't noticed, like everybody's obsessed with that. And then you go back another 20 years and we're obsessed with the 80s.
Mm. Yeah.
And then as we like go towards like 2030, mm. we become obsessed with like, you know, the 90s. I mean,
yeah. Maybe 2040, people will be listening back to high school and revisiting it. And they, you know, yeah, I feel like it's interesting and important to, you know, be able to like listen to music from the past, even though we weren't alive, obviously, when it was created, and kind of rework that into what we do. But yeah, the 80s are sick. So yeah, stoked about that.
Do you think there's also a sense of escapism in it, in that nostalgia in looking back gives you a way to kind of escape things that are happening right now?
Well, I think humans can only look back. Like, we can't look into the future. So we really can only look at the present and then the past, you know. So it's kind of like we don't have anything else to, like, look at.
Yeah, yeah. I think nostalgia is definitely a big thing. I mean, kind of accidentally, but the nostalgia sort of term gets thrown out a lot when people listen to our music, which is super positive. Like, I like the fact that if we can, like, evoke some memory for someone. I think we had like a guy come up to us after a gig the other day. He's like, man, like, I listened to your set and it reminded me of like when I was in school in the 80s, and it just made me so happy. And I'm like, that's a massive kind of thing, you know, like to be able to hear someone say that is awesome. So
but yeah. The visuals are just as important for you guys in that. But on stage you guys are wearing almost uniform-esque getup. Yeah. And I noticed the music video for Jerry is shot like it's a one take.
Yeah.
It is one take.
Yeah. It seems like your approach is that the music is kind of part of an artistic whole.
Definitely.
Do you see the music as the sort of start point, the end point, or part of something bigger that you want to go on and make?
No. I think like everything surrounding the music is of equally artistic value as the music itself.
Mm. I feel like when we were in Melbourne, we were spending so much time on the visuals and kind of pulling this sort of look together. And since we've been here, we've just like purely focused on songwriting. We're writing a record at the moment, and we kind of have taken the sort of visual aspects have sort of taken a back seat. But yeah, I think people get equally as obsessed with how the band look and whatnot as they do the sound of the music. Yeah. And if you listen to my favorite bands I listen to, I'm super interested in what they look like as well as just the track, you know. So.
You mentioned that you took that unanimous decision to move from Australia to London last year.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, I guess the people we were working with here, like we kind of released a couple of singles, and then we got in touch with Rich Walker, who sort of started managing us, and then we went on to sort of start working with BRM. They do our publishing, and they kind of, suggested that it would be a good idea to kind of move here, do the festival circuit, start trying to build more of an audience here. And I think the general consensus was the sound sort of lent itself to a English market and a European market.
And
we were just kind of bored in Melbourne. We're like,
It was just like all our team was here, and also all our fans were here. So it was just like a natural move.
Definitely.
I didn't realize this, but Melbourne used to be the live music capital of the world, hosting something like 62,000 live events every single year. How do you find the Melbourne and the London music scenes compare?
It's a good question. I think everything post Big Day Out, I don't know if you know Big Day Out, has been trash in Melbourne, really. I'm a big Melbourne lover. I'm not going to move from Melbourne and like start hating on it, but I feel like, the Big Day Out was this like brilliant festival that happened around Australia, like maybe up till about 2012, and just like hosted like the most insane lineups and stuff. And I don't know, since then I feel like it's kind of different.
Melbourne's music scene is really good, and it's like maybe the gig scene is a lot more makeshift, you know, like it's much easier to get a gig, and a lot more like gigs happen in a more like piecemeal kind of way, you know. There's probably like more places to play as an amateur in Melbourne, and it's more makeshift, but London is just so enormous, and you guys like London probably has like more things going on, you know, just due to like population size.
London's sick.
So your first gig was in London. How are you finding Margate? Have you had a chance to visit?
Love Margate.
We're
staying at Henry Young's house. Big shout out.
Thanks, Henry.
He's put us up. We met him at our first gig in Margate about 4 months ago at Elsewhere. He was playing a after-party DJ set. I'm pretty sure he was just on it. I think it was just an aux in Spotify, realistically. But, No, we love Margate. It's great. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, we were gutted because we've had a chance to walk around today and we've spotted the Crab Museum, but it's only open on a Saturday and Sunday. It turns out it's Europe's only and largest museum dedicated to crabs.
Whoa. Crab Museum.
Yeah.
Tomorrow is Saturday. Yeah.
Tomorrow is Saturday.
Yes, let's go.
Yeah. I'm keen. I love a crab.
And our final question for you then. Of all the things you can do today at Dreamland, there's a roller disco, there's an amusement park. We've noticed that you can get slushies in every single colour. What's your favourite slushy colour slash combination? What would you go
for? Oh, I thought you were going to ask, what ride are we going to go on? So I had a good answer for that.
And also, what ride are you
slushy colour, I'm talking cherry, personally. What about you?
Dude, I'm thinking rainbow, slushy colours together.
But in terms of rides, we were going to, hopefully, if they're running, we wanted to get a press pick on the ghost train. Because that felt like our vibe, you know, like a little ghoul popping out behind us.
Yeah, is that running, that ghost train?
Yeah. Oh, I feel like you've got to get back in the school uniform and sit very stoic and faced in the front. 100%.
No, definitely. So I think it'll be like a cherry slush puppy for me on the ghost train after this interview, I think.
Amazing. Thank you both so much.
No worries. Thank you.
Before we move on, a reminder, you can get the Culture Bunker and all our shows early and without adverts when you support the Bunker on Patreon. That means daily episodes on politics, science, pop culture and much more, plus all manner of exciting merchandise and special shows just for you. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. And now let's go back to Andrew and Sean, our field reporters, quite literally in a field, with a potted review of their second day at Glastonbury.
Well, hello, it's 24 hours later. We're still at the Glastonbury Festival. We are now in the backstage area, which is full of the... There you go, there's...
Not cool, man.
The man having had a wheel of fence behind us. Anyway, we're still here in the backstage area, me and Sean, and also we've got a very special guest who took a lot of wrangling to get him on board, talk to his PRs. It's the news editor of Mojo Magazine, Ian Harrison. Hello.
Hello.
Sean, have you been having a good day?
Yeah, it's been great today. I really enjoyed it.
It's a really nice, warm evening, isn't it?
Till the evening, yes.
Well, it's what time is it? It's quarter past.
It's late afternoon. Yes. We've still got a lot left.
Yeah, we've got a lot left to do. So, what have been the main takeaways of today? We started the day with something quite remarkable, didn't we?
We did indeed. We saw Kikugaku Moyo, a Japanese group. And I have to be honest with you, I did not know a great deal about them. But somebody said, you've got to go and see them. They're great. And they were. And it was an added specialness was added because it's their last British show ever. And they are disbanding. They're going to play a couple
of
dates in
Europe.
What do
they sound like? Because I'm really annoyed I missed it.
They sound like... there is the sort of the wildly soloing sort of, you know, stripy pants, you know, hippie underground ethic.
Yeah.
But also bits where they sound very mellifluous, like sort of, you know, an instrumental guitar group, you know, very melodic as well. But again, you're kind of on very shifting ground constantly, but in a very good way. The group are all, you know, clearly playing together.
They look great. The main guitarist looks like Japanese Dave Grohl. The bass player looks like Japanese Fergal Sharkey. They've got an electric sitar player.
Wow.
Behind them, they've got visuals which are like an unfolding fungal brain universe.
Appearing
in purple.
Damn that they're never playing again.
I know, why are you split up? You're only getting started. Come out with
I
you.
Know, I know. No, seriously, I know that they're going to play a couple of European dates. I'm always feeling like I might even go to them because I enjoyed it so much.
Crazy.
That just might be the lunacy of the day.
Yeah. My favourite bit was in the middle of this kind of clattering, cyclonic rock maelstrom where everything's been played in 12-13 time, you know, and pi r squared time.
Key change, keys
you've never even heard of.
Negative chords.
Yeah, negative chords. They suddenly started basically playing Take Five.
Yeah, they played Take Five.
But in a wild 1972, or is it the year 3000 Japanese acid
This sounds
rock.
Like the most Glastonbury.
It was tremendous fun.
I'm not lying, it's one of the best things I've seen. They were really, really great.
And you missed it because you were doing what?
My phone had no battery in, so I didn't know where you were.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, ran down.
So that was good. What else have we seen today?
Well, we saw Gabriels, didn't we?
I had no idea about Gabriels. That was fantastic.
Tell the listeners who Gabriels
are. Well, I know very little because I have only discovered this fantastic band.
Isn't that great? You know, I'm led to believe that the singer, whose name escapes me, I do apologise, I think he might have won an American talent show.
Yes.
Don't hold it against him.
Yeah.
He has got tremendous...
He's got pipes.
He's got the most amazing
pipes. He's got pipes on pipes.
He is an intense channel. channeler of all emotions.
Yeah.
And he looks smart on stage.
Also, he came on wearing not just a full tuxedo yes. with bow tie, but also a kind of graduation day cape.
Yeah.
Where it looked like he was about to inaugurate the new year for Hufflepuff or something. And... Yeah, he struck, I mean, older listeners, of which we don't have any, will remember Sir Harry Bowen of Was Not Was fame, yeah, a little bit like that.
Yeah.
This guy's got range that you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
And we ping-pong from gospel to slowies to testifying souls. Yeah. To
super Philly soul as well. Modern Philly soul, which I hadn't heard for a long time.
And house with a great big smile in the background. And honestly, he was getting, also, he converted us all to the Church of Glastonbury. Glastonbury.
Glastonbury Missionary Baptist Church. Yeah. Yeah, so we're all in it now.
So we all had to turn to our neighbours and say, I love you, you're important to me.
Some of us didn't do that because we're too cynical.
I did.
Yeah, but you were next to your brothers.
No, I didn't. Someone else. To some guy, go to you. That was just wonderful. What else have we done? We've just seen Self-Esteem, haven't we?
Yes.
And she was clearly having a moment, wasn't she?
Absolute moment. And it was totally packed to the point where there's so many people outside the tent. She should have got a bigger tent. They should have given her one. That was, you know, how the annoying thing when people say it's empowering. Well, I felt I had some power already, but yeah, maybe I've got a little bit extra. Slightly teary to, I do this all the time, the finale, because I really love
her. Also, as a presentation level, Sean, you notice an emerging theme of the festival.
Of course. So we had Confidence Man, who we mentioned yesterday, who had these Jean-Paul Gaultier boobs, kind of Janet did.
Ones.
Very, very pointy and spiky, perhaps more so. And we had Self-Esteem today, who had... plastic boobs,
yes.
extra ones.
Plassy boobs.
Yeah, plassy boobs.
Plassy dudes.
Yeah. And she reminded me of Janet Jackson, I was telling you at the time. There was something of that thing of, fuck you, I'm going to just do what I want. Stormers. Absolute magic. And what was so nice was to see young kids and young girls singing all the lyrics back to her. Yep. There's such an adoration. What I really like about her is she's connected with people just almost magically. Yes. So there's a really strong bond between audience and performer, but at Glastonbury, that's what you want to see.
It was very good. I wish you could have got in. Although we have to ask then, who will be the third wearer of the boobs? And will it be Tony Christie?
Yes, we're expecting it.
Might be Tony Christie.
I'm going to go see him. I'll let you know if he does.
Will it be Lord Macca?
It might be.
It might be.
He might have three, just to be, you know, one louder.
Yeah.
She was great. And you were saying that she was kind of like articulating something that had not been properly articulated at Glastonbury before, weren't you?
I was indeed.
Yes.
What exactly did I say? The mental health of Janet Jackson.
It's
mainly what we were saying. Yeah. No, but she does that, and it's that wonderful thing of she's really fuck you, but she's also really, I fucked up as well. I hate to use the word vulnerable, but she's so honest, and as I say, what's so nice is to see it connect. People really get it, and girls really, really love her. And it works in a place like this. It's not just psychedelic Japanese.
Yeah, we've missed loads of the things that you're supposed to see.
Oh, I didn't see Eve 2 more. I wanted to see. We missed that because it's just too far away to get there in time.
It is, yeah. I mean, I would like to have seen Robert Plant and Alison Krauss.
Apparently they were storming.
Apparently they were really good. When they were doing, somebody was doing Jimmy Page on the violin.
Macca, that's what I want to know, because I might skip Macca.
I think I've got to see it.
Really?
Yeah,
there's a moment?
I think it's going to be. Yes.
So tonight, Macca, we're going to try and do a bit of Block 9, aren't we?
I think Tony Christie as well would be good. I think he might be quite good.
We're going to revisit things tomorrow morning in a bit about Macca, so we can just assess the whole thing, which you'll be hearing immediately after this bit. What else is up for this evening? I mean, I think Russian Murphy has got a bit of a tough deal because she's up against Paul McCartney. And
true.
I know that they're not in the same wheel park.
Yeah. Well, Megan Thee Stallion is also on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't see any Megan Thee Stallion fans going.
Well, we should say, though, that TLC has been the most popular, liked... was it on the Twitter or on the app? I mean, TLC just drew a massive...
I'm furious at missing this. And
yes, me too.
There was the greatest moment ever of audience participation, which is a young lady from the crowd just climbed up on one of these extremely very, very high flagpoles and did a fully professional pole dance routine at the top of it.
She was upside down.
Upside down. Inside out. Just like Diana Ross.
Yeah.
She did the full deal, and people
were...
stupefied and amazed.
Skills.
So this is the great thing.
Skills, nice.
Glastonbury breaks down the barrier between artist and audience. The fourth wall. Do you get it being broken there?
There's a fifth wall somewhere that's rumbling as well. It's going to go.
We're going to fall through it.
I'm
really going to start kicking off.
So, I mean, okay, it's halfway through. It's Saturday. How are we going to assess Glastonbury 2022, do you think?
Oh, God, we're going to assess it. It was so brilliant. There you go.
It is. It's like...
We're going to forget about it being cold in the tent.
It's not that
cold. People nicking your your stuff. It wasn't.
No one has nicked any stuff. My tent is actually quite horrible and squalid and uncomfortable, but I don't mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and we've run into a few people who are like, oh, I'm staying off. So I was actually in a stately home. I was like, no, you're not doing Glastonbury then, are you?
No.
If you're in a stately home,
yeah,
you're what you're doing at the weekend is going to a stately home.
I also now think that about people who've had showers. I hope you two. It's like, why are you doing Glastonbury and having a shower? You're not meant to.
I haven't had a shower.
Good.
I forgot my towel.
Yeah,
I was going to try and get one in. Yeah. But, yeah.
As we all know, after a few days, you become waterproof. So it's a good idea. Yeah.
Well, you clean yourself.
You do.
Bob Geldof always used to say he doesn't wash his hair because it takes care of itself after a while.
Yeah. It does. Yeah. You can mould it into the shapes that you want if it's really manky.
I'm glad to have any at all, whatever shape it might be.
Yeah.
So listeners at home, by the time you hear this, the festival will be over, but we'll be back with you in a few moments in the distant future, talking about Macca on Saturday night. And, whose round is it?
Mine. Is it yours?
Yes, it's yours.
We've done his podcast. Yeah. He owes us a drink.
He certainly does. Okay, back to you in the studio.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello and welcome back to part three of the Glastonbury Odyssey. Sean is leading this one, I believe, because Andrew Harrison cannot speak very well. What have you been doing all night, Andrew?
I've been doing a lot of shows against dusty environments, and I think it may have destroyed my podcasting career. I sound like Joe Pasquale, for a change.
Never mind, but have you had fun?
Have a tremendous fun.
Who was good yesterday, then?
Well, yesterday, the Avalanches. I think the Avalanche is the great Australian DJ outfit. I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen anywhere, never mind at Glastonbury. Mm. They did the whole thing based on their album, which we talked about a lot when this podcast was called Big Mouth, which is called We Will Always Love You, and it's about ascending into space of human information and how it means that everyone you love that has gone has not gone. And it, honestly, it really got me. It was just quite
wasn't
incredible.
It fantastic?
Beautiful.
Absolutely, yeah. That's, I think, maybe the highlight, but definitely one of the highlights of yesterday and the weekend, yeah.
Yes. And then we had to talk about Macca, don't we?
We have
Macca.
To.
Now, you didn't enjoy Macca, did you?
I didn't enjoy Macca, and I know a lot of people did seem to drift away because he wasn't playing the hits for the first hour.
Mm.
And that is a problem if you're Paul McCartney. But then, who does he invite on as a special guest?
Oh, hello, it's Dave Grohl. Oh, hello, it's Bruce Springsteen. Oh, hello, it's Her Majesty the Queen and Incredible Hulk.
Everybody. And a panda. I mean, he had it all. And so he did actually sort of rescue it, I think, in the second half. It did then sort of come together and be really rather exciting and an experience, some of that. But yeah. I do think he could have done, made a bit more of an effort.
He made you work for it, because the first half was a lot of, here's a song I wrote about my wife, and he was, oh God, there were some shouts around us of play one we know. But then, you know, the finale is just, you know, it's Hey Jude and, you know, Beatles bangers and Live and Let Die with Fireworks. And but my favourite bit, because I mean, I'm not, you know, I am Beatle agnostic. They're not the stuff of my existence the way they are with some people. But I was amazed that he played Helter Skelter as the ultimate song.
Yes,
the crazy Manson inspiring.
Yeah, that was a bit of
incipient
touch,
alt rock madness of Helter Skelter. Yeah. Like, yeah, this is great. I wish it started with this. This is really what I put a line in the sand and put a peg on the board and told people where you're at.
Yes, he wasn't doing avant-garde Paul till that point, was he?
He wasn't doing avant-garde Paul. I like Art Paul. Art Paul is the best.
Yes. So what do we see afterwards? So obviously Glastonbury is an enormous field filled with, it seems, raves and dance tents and all sorts of things going on there.
Yes, I wandered mindlessly from rave to rave, and it's impossible to pin down, really. But the kind of huge, and obviously you group splinters as well, and you lose people. You know, the kind of the vastness of it now is such that I used to get really wound up about missing things. Oh God, I've missed this, I've missed that. And now you've just got to accept that, you know, if you had a time machine and could come back every Friday infinitely, you still couldn't see it all.
Absolutely.
So,
because I wandered off home, I thought, I'll get some sleep. Home being the tent. Then I saw some Acid House play. I heard it first and just thought, this sounds brilliant. It was a really, really small tent. So I just went and danced for an hour.
Okay.
It was really, really good. And it's one of those things where Glastonbury is just absolutely unique in that most atmospheres feel really safe. It's really lovely people who are just wanting to have loads and loads of fun in the field.
Yeah, you've turned into a hippie. What would it be like if people were nice? Discuss.
Stop it.
So anyway, we should wrap up now and let people get back to whatever they're doing on their square Sunday in the square real world, man. But people may have noticed a slight change in the audio here. Why is that, Sean?
We are in a luxury yurt. It's not ours.
We've flagged entry to a luxury yurt.
Yeah, for 10 minutes.
Living in a yurt, living in a cardboard yurt.
Yeah, so, everybody yurt.
Everybody yurt. Anyway, we're signing off now.
We are.
This is Planet Yurt. Sian and Andrew sending you back to the studio.
And with that, we're at the end of the podcast. But since there are two of us here and we also have the fabulous Linda Marrick at hand, let's do a mini closing time chatter. What we'll be recommending to our smelly comrades as we queue for an hour to use a chemical toilet. Linda, anything in the cinemas we might have missed?
Yeah, actually, there is unusually, I'm going to talk about a sort of a B-movie, sort of horror movie starring Ethan Hawke, which I really liked. It's one of those Blumhouse horrors that, I mean, they seem to be churning them out every 5 minutes. But I really like this because it's set in a kind of in the sort of late 70s, early 80s. And it almost embodies what those films that were released, horror films that were released around that time, feel like. And I think I really liked it. I think it's only been released in cinema. It's not available anywhere online. And I think it's very brave to release sort of such a small movie in the cinema when there are so many horrors being released every single day for streamings. But I really liked it. So it's sort of... It feels almost like a sort of film based on a true story, but it isn't. It's one of those Blumhouse sort of concocted from different ideas. It's directed by Scott Derrickson, and it stars Ethan Hawke and Mason Thames, James Ransone, and Gina John. And yeah, that's all I have to say to you about it. And I really liked it. I think it's a fantastic movie. Go see it if you can.
Yelena, how about you?
I've been continuing on my travels, I suppose, and I've been absolutely binging a series of YouTube videos about Towards a Concrete Utopia, which was a MoMA exhibition in 2018 about modernist architecture in Yugoslavia. This is relevant, I promise. Last week, there was really harrowing news about Spomenik, which is a World War II war memorial that was attacked in Bosnia and basically covered with fascist graffiti. And a real reminder of how alive that conflict remains. And these fantastic exhibitions like the MoMA one really do a lot to show how important art was during the socialist period and how exciting it was more than anything as well. So, yeah, some fantastic videos that I've been renewing my interest in. And given that I'm hopefully off to the Balkans at the end of July for a 2-year COVID postponed trip, it feels very, very overdue. So that's what I've been indulging in this week.
Very good.
And Alex, what about you?
So I'm going to go high and low. So I would suggest for anyone who wants the outdoor festival atmosphere but is more inclined towards the classical, there is a really, really interesting double bill at the Opera Holland Park, which is putting on a production of Le Villi by Puccini, which is Puccini's very first opera. It's a little one-act delight, a very short opera, and it's usually paired with something else. And on this occasion, it's paired with Delius's Margot la Rouge, which is might seem a very unusual pairing to sort of put a British composer in there with Puccini. But Margot la Rouge was an opera that Delius submitted to the Verismo competition by Puccini's publisher, Sanzogno, 8 years after Le Villi. So it was Delius's attempt to enter this very, very Italian arena, largely unsuccessful, I should say. But it's a really, really interesting double bill, and it's on at Opera Holland Park throughout July and August, so I'd recommend it quite highly. And then on the low side, I've been watching Miss Marvel on Disney Plus, and I know I've read all the reviews. I can see quite clearly that it's targeted directly at a sort of female teen audience, and maybe that says something about my psyche, but I absolutely love it. It's one of my favorite recent Marvel things, so I would recommend that quite highly.
And that's The Culture Bunker. Thanks for listening to this special Outward Bound edition. It's business as usual when we return this time next week.
From Yelena, Sean, Andrew, Linda, our hardworking producer Jade, and from me, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
The Culture Bunker was written and presented by Alex Andreou and Yelena Sofronievich, with Andrew Harrison and Sean Pattenden. The group editor was also Andrew Harrison, and the producers were Yelena Sofronievich and me, Jade Bailey, who's not at all jealous that she's not at Glastonbury. And The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Papercuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including TikTok comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Papercuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. Like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star, proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Papercuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Papercuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thank you.